Dementia in Practice is recorded and produced in multiple locations. We acknowledge the traditional custodians of the various lands on which we meet. We pay our respects to elders past, present, and emerging, and celebrate the diversity of Aboriginal peoples, their ongoing cultures, and connections to the lands and waters of Australia. Hi, it's Hilton Coppy here, and welcome back to Dementia in Practice, a podcast that's made by GPs, for GPs, and for any other allied health professionals who are interested in learning more about dementia. As always, I'm joined by my friends and colleagues from Dementia Training Australia's GP education team, Marita Long and Steph Daly.
Hello.
Hi, Hilton. You're really fortunate to be able to spend some time with a young fellow who helped care for his father with younger onset dementia. It sounds like he was pretty generous in sharing his experience. And the reason we really love having people with lived experience on the podcast is because it really does reach people's hearts, doesn't it, to understand the impact that dementia has on the person with it, obviously, but also the people caring for them. So I'm really excited to have a listen to this conversation.
Yeah, well, I was in Castlemaine near to where Spencer Ratcliffe lives, and we had an opportunity to share a conversation over some nice local Castlemaine coffee in a studio there. And as a not quite as young man with a father who died not quite as young from dementia, it was a very rich and meaningful experience for me. So let's hear what little of what Spencer had to say.
It probably helps to give a bit of an indication of what my dad was like pre-diagnosis, because I think that when you start to see the change in the behaviour and the personality, that's when you start to ask the questions. And Dad was always a really confident and witty and driven and active personality. And I guess started to see over time that confidence was starting to deteriorate a little bit. There was a period as well where there was uncertainty in his career, and he started asking questions about whether or not he was, you know, in the right career, and he had plans that he wanted to move to the country, and very out of character, some of the suggestions and behaviour that was happening there. And I can remember at the time actually having a conversation with Mum where she expressed that she had some concern that perhaps he was, you know, experiencing some sort of depression or midlife crisis, if you will, and that we needed to be mindful of that and to, you know, sort of spend some time with him and I guess cheer him up a bit, because it seemed like, you know, there were those changes there. I mentioned he was also incredibly active, and so he was up at the crack of dawn going to the gym twice a day sometimes, and, you know, he started to go to bed quite early and get quite tired. And I think over time we realised that that was probably mental fatigue contributing to that more than anything. He did an incredible job of hiding from us, I think, how much he was struggling. But that obviously got to a point where it became quite obvious to us.
So when you say things were obvious, what was obvious? What were the things that became noticeable?
Yeah, it's hard to explain, but it's just, it seemed like he wasn't himself. That lack of confidence, it seemed like he was just, I suppose, struggling with really basic things. I mean, there's the really obvious things. So I'll give you an example. I was actually due to move overseas around the time that Dad was diagnosed. We had a farewell party and a dinner. And at the end of the dinner, Dad forgot my now wife's name, who I'd been dating for 5 years at the time. In hindsight, you go, wow, that is a red flag, my dad forgetting my partner's name. But there were things like that. He'd ask the same question twice. We'd be in the car and he'd have to ask me which way he needed to turn, and on a route that he'd driven 1,000 times before. And these were all uncharacteristic of Dad's personality. And so I guess you start to think, well, is he just getting old? But, you know, he was in his mid-50s. But, you know, now looking back, you think, well, that was all because of what he was experiencing in the early stages of the dementia.
And if you were to put yourself in your dad's shoes at that time, pre-seeking assistance,
yeah,
what do you imagine might have been happening for him? You mentioned you think he was fatigued from trying to keep going. How do you imagine it might have been for him?
horrible. And, you know, that's something that I look back on with sadness, is what he would have been going through and thinking and not wanting to burden his family with that. I think that he knew something was wrong. Before I left to go overseas, you know, when I said goodbye to him, he was overly emotional. I think back at that and I think, what was he thinking? What did he know about himself and the changes, and potentially he was trying to shield us from that? When we found out about the diagnosis, we knew that he was sort of on borrowed time, if you will. But I felt from him an incredible sense of relief when he found out what was wrong, which seems odd because you're being told that you've got a terminal illness, but I could tell that it was a relief for him and to some degree for the rest of us as well, to go, well, this is what's wrong. Now we know, now we can put a name on it, and now I guess we work through what the next stage of this looks like.
So we talk at times about offering the gift of a diagnosis.
Yep.
And it sounds for you and your family and your dad that even though the diagnosis was so harsh, it was still a gift in a way because it gave you a pathway.
Yes.
So can you tell us a little about what that pathway was from the time of diagnosis? You've moved from being a bit unsure, I think there might be something going on, and then now you've got this diagnosis.
Yeah. I think the first thing that we thought was is, I hope they've got this wrong. I hope that it's not CJD. Unfortunately, with CJD, the only definitive test that they have is taking brain tissue once the patient has passed away. So we never really got that certainty until, you know, it was sort of, it didn't matter whether it was CJD or not. But I think at the start, we were thinking, I hope it's not this. I think that we knew, though, that it was. And, you know, we then began the process of really making sure that Dad felt comfortable, and that was our number one priority. I think that the natural instinct when you know that someone has a terminal illness is to want to have all of those conversations that you've never had a chance to have. You want to resolve all of the conflicts that you've had over the years. You want to ask them the hard questions. You want to tell them things you've been too afraid to tell them. And I guess we understood and appreciated that not only was Dad also processing the diagnosis and coming to terms with what that meant, but he was also experiencing the confusion that comes with dementia and his condition. And so it was quite challenging because there was selfishly the things that we wanted to do and the conversations we wanted to have, but also understanding, well, that probably wouldn't be fair on Dad. And so our focus very quickly shifted on making sure that he was as comfortable as possible. Dad was given 6 months tops is what they sort of said to us. And Dad lived just over 2 years. That first 12 months was some of the, you know, most special time that I've had with my dad, and being able to spend that time with him. And I think that at my age as well, you're probably in your early adolescence and then into the start of adulthood, you don't want to spend too much time with your parents. And so I would avoid spending much time with my mum and dad as much as I could. But then really being able to appreciate our time together during that period. The second 12 months was certainly a lot more challenging than the first 12. With Dad's condition, he lost the ability to walk and talk and sort of communicate completely. So that was certainly challenging. But I think the first 12 months, yeah, he was probably sick of me by the end of it because I spent every chance I got with him, and the entire family did.
Yeah. Dementia's sort of as an older person's condition. Your dad wasn't an older person. What was it like having a younger father with a dementia?
I still very much looked up to my dad as the all-knowing beacon of just everything that, you know, was important. And I still seeked all of my advice from him. And seeing him, I suppose, compromised cognitively and experience that confusion at such a young age was certainly a shock. You don't ever expect that you're going to take on the role of caring for your parent at such a young age. And so that was certainly challenging. I didn't really think of it as dementia, I guess. I think that there were so many things that Dad experienced as part of his diagnosis that was probably one of them. And it's probably only after now that I've since reflected on it and understood more, and some of the conversations I've had with you as well about, you know, what dementia is and the many different, you know, diseases that it encompasses.
What a privilege it was to spend that time together with Spencer. There's so much learning that I was able to gain from speaking with him in that way. Steph, what have you taken from the first part of the interview?
I think it's hard to pick just one thing because he eloquently described all of the challenges that particularly somebody who is younger experiences when they're trying to live through, you know, obtaining a diagnosis and experiencing that. You know, often people who are younger have younger kids, they have a working life, they spend a long time waiting to get a diagnosis because, as he said, sometimes it's thought it's like a midlife crisis or depression. And so you only have to listen to the story to really understand some of the challenges that people can experience.
Yeah, the value of story. And we often talk about lived experience, but actually for Spencer, it's living experience that he was able to share. It's not past tense, it's present tense for him. Marita, what about for you in listening to that?
Yeah, I think it was really amazing, I suppose, how, I suppose what Steph said in lots of ways, it's he's so articulate about it. And obviously, you know, has an inquiring mind, so learnt a lot about it. I think the thing that's really important for listeners is that the family really rallied to spend as much quality time with their dad and partner to not only, as he sort of said, that balance of to meet their needs and their desires, but also to protect and care for their dad and obviously for his wife. So I thought that was quite important because, you know, life can be so incredibly busy with so many challenges, and just turning his mind to spending all that time, you know, with his dad. And in a sense, I guess that makes some really special memories that mean he's in a space where he can talk to us about his experience, because there's very few regrets. He put that his mind into really attending to the relationship and to the family.
And so there was like this duality that Spencer articulated so well. What were my needs as a son? But he prioritised what were the needs for my father. And we went on to talk a little bit about the supports that were available to help the whole family manage the coming situation.
We were very lucky. Obviously, Dad, being under the age of 65 when he was diagnosed, meant that he was eligible for the NDIS. I think of recent times, we often hear about the negatives or the issues with the NDIS, whether that be appropriate funding or fraud, but it's an incredibly beneficial scheme and something that helped our family greatly during Dad's diagnosis and illness. We were hit with COVID. Unfortunately, Dad was in a bit of an awkward situation whereby he wasn't quite eligible to be in aged care. Hospitals didn't really know what to do. And palliative care, you sort of only meant to be there for 2 weeks. So there was a bit of an awkward situation where Mum wasn't really sure where Dad was going to go and how we were going to be caring for him. And all that we knew is that we wanted to be able to spend as much time with Dad as possible and make him feel as comfortable as possible. And the NDIS actually allowed us to bring Dad home and have care in the home. So my mum did an incredible job along with my brother and sister, but we also had nurses that were coming into the home and supporting. We got a hospital bed, all of the necessary supports that we needed to be able to get my dad comfortable and at home were able to be funded through his NDIS plan. One of the things with the NDIS is that you really do need to have a good understanding or a good advocate, because it can be quite challenging at times to get the most out of the plan. And, you know, especially when you're dealing with a disease like CJD, which is 1 in 1 million, I doubt that many NDIS planners have had too much experience with that condition. So knowing the types of support and, I guess, you know, really fighting for what you need. But ultimately, we were able to get the required funding to cover those supports. And without that, who knows, you know, what position we would have been in and what financial implications that could have had if we would have to self-fund those supports.
Because I guess during COVID, for your dad to be in residential care might have meant you wouldn't have been able to see him at all.
No. So my mum was actually in palliative care. This is 12 months, mind you, before Dad passed away, he was in palliative care. And the nurses came into the room and said to mum, they've just announced that there's another lockdown. You have to leave the building immediately. So mum was ushered out of the palliative care and not knowing when we might next see my dad. I think it was 2 weeks we went without being able to see dad. And that was that during that 2 week period that mum fought and got us the funding to bring dad home. So yeah, incredibly grateful for mum and all that she did during that period, because I touched on earlier, when you sort of know that you're on borrowed time, you're thinking, well, is that it? Am I not going to be able to get to see him? And he was 2 streets away. We couldn't see him, but we're, you know, thankfully we were able to bring him home. And I have no doubt as well that the care that we were able to provide him by having him at home and mum, there's no way. I mean, he was given 6 months. He lived for over 2 years. And I think that the reason for that is because of the care that he was given. He's probably the only person that was terminally ill that put on weight, because my mum was feeding him so much and he was so well fed. But, you know, yeah, incredibly grateful for that and the support that the NDIS was able to give.
You undertook a little project with your dad during this time to make some recordings.
Yeah, I was actually given some advice. A friend of mine whose father passed away a few years before mine, she said to me that the one thing that I wish that I had, or that I wish that I could have, is to hear my dad's laugh and to hear his voice. And so she had lots of photos and that really stuck with me. And another one of my friends contacted her and we were able to get a camera and some microphones up to Castlemaine, which is where my dad was at the time. And this was early days as well. So dad was still able to have a conversation. And, you know, mind you, it was definitely challenging to get him to sit down and talk to me for an hour. And I was also very mindful not to say to him, hey, can I record you? Because this might be the last time I get to get something on film. But I think I told him it was a project for work or something like that. But he knew, he definitely knew why I was doing it. And it was so incredible. We got to chat about, you know, his move to Sydney when I was 2 years of age and him starting his own business. And we talked about his time at school and his family and what it was like for him raising a family. And we laughed and then we cried. And it's something that I still look back on. And I would encourage anyone listening, you know, if they have a family member or friend with dementia and, you know, they're able to still have a conversation, it's worthwhile, because it's something that I look back on all the time. And in particular, it's very easy to reflect and think about what someone was like at the end of their life when they were sick, especially because dad was sick for so long. But I look back on that video and it just reminds me of the person that dad was pre-diagnosis. And so it's something that, you know, I mean, I look forward to showing my kids that one day and saying to them, well, this is who you're grandfather was. He was a legend, and they get to see it for themselves.
So have you edited that recording, or is it pretty much just raw?
No, we sat down for 1 hour. We both cracked a beer, sat in front of the fireplace, and we just chatted. And so completely unedited. That's probably why I haven't shown a few people that, because there were some topics that we covered during that chat which may be inappropriate for everyone to hear. And so my brother and sister and mum have asked to see it, and I've been selective in the clips that I show them from it. But I've got the full unedited 1 hour, and yeah, I watch it all the time.
Yeah, very precious, yep. I imagine. Yep. I wonder if you could tell us a little about how your dad's diagnosis and journey with CJD impacted on you from a career point of view.
Yeah. When mum and I started to look into the NDIS and look at the types of services that were available, one of the services was ready-made meals, you know, nutritious meals that are delivered to the home for someone who can't prepare meals themselves. But also he had dysphagia at the end, and so, you know, the inability to swallow properly. And so we're looking into texture-modified options. And there weren't sort of specialist disability providers that understood the NDIS. you know, getting your funding is one thing, but then getting a provider that understands how to access the supports and can talk you through what needs to happen. And so, much to the bewilderment of my family and my now wife, decided to quit my job and start my own business. So Able Foods is a disability specialist, ready-made meal provider, which was born out of Dad's diagnosis and wanting to find a provider. We were the first provider to offer both normal meals but also texture-modified meals delivered to the home as a registered NDIS provider. So it's something I'm really proud of that, you know, you sort of think about, well, what's the silver lining out of Dad's diagnosis? Obviously, the time that I got to spend with Dad, that 12 months with him, but then also I'm just incredibly proud of a business that was able to be born out of it. I actually was able to have conversations with my dad about starting this business, and he really gave me the confidence to go away and do it. So it's one small part of Dad's legacy, I think.
So as you reflect back on the time since your dad was diagnosed, that journey for 2 years, and then after he's died, what sort of other reflections have you had personally, Spencer, that you take with you from that experience that you might like to share?
You probably hear this quite a bit. It's a tried and tested piece of advice that people give, but just not to wait to say things that you want to say and spend time with your family. I think that what I learn as well is that family is the most important thing in the world. And I guess, you know, seeing how every single person in my family really rose to the occasion for my dad and support my dad made me incredibly grateful for my family. You know, my mum and my brother and my sister and my wife, Alex, I've got a newfound love for them that I probably didn't have before, because I know that they've got my back no matter what, and we've got each other's back. And so although it was an incredibly challenging time and it really tested us, it really strengthened us as a family. And just don't take your family for granted, because, you know, they're the ones that are there for you no matter what, you know, unconditional love. And so, you know, I think that's something I take away from it. I mean, the memories that I had with Dad as well. Sometimes I think that I was robbed of time with Dad. I think about, you know, where I want to go as a man and starting a family of my own. And I think that Dad was such a hard worker that I feel like it's such a shame that he didn't get to wind down, I guess, and experience what life as a retired man was like and as a grandfather. And I think that reflecting on that is sometimes upsetting. But, you know, I'm still incredibly grateful for the time that I got to spend with him, and his memory certainly lives on.
Well, I'm incredibly grateful for the time that I've had to spend with you as well, Spencer, and your father's memory will live on through this recording for all our listeners. So thank you so much for sharing your dad's story and your story with us today.
No, thank you. It was a pleasure.
Such a beautiful example of finding meaning in suffering and the support when a family can pull together. Sadly, we know not all families are as solid a unit as what Spencer's family is. So not everyone has the opportunity for that family support. Any other reflections, Marita and Steph?
I guess thinking about what I can do as the GP supporting that family, one thing I'd really encourage everyone to think about is things like getting that NDIS support early, or in the case of somebody who's over the age of 65, the My Age Care referral, because you heard how that really made a difference. And they still had to advocate quite hard to work out what they needed as a family. So as you know, the GP, we can help patients and people to look for those sorts of supports that they might need and write that down in the NDIS support plan so that, you know, that is there to benefit people. And I think if we, especially for the younger person, sometimes if you don't act quickly, things can change very quickly and that opportunity for putting in supports is missed. And as the GP, you can regularly follow people up as well and just touch base to see, because there's so much going on for families. You know, we can be really there just to keep things ticking over and make sure they've got that ongoing support to help them through.
I think for me, and again, the same as you, Hilton, having a father who died from dementia, and I've got some beautiful videos of my dad that were just very offhand, and that whole discussion about feeling like he couldn't consent for me to be videoing him because he couldn't at that stage. But I look at those all the time, and, you know, it brings back these incredible memories of, you know, some fun times we had when we were dressing Dad, or at one point in time he had developed this funny way of talking, and or he would come up with classic expressions, and it's just so nice to look back on those. You know, if I ever lost them, I think I'd be so upset. So I think for listeners, as Spencer said, you know, taking that opportunity to do some conversations and some filming, or at least, you know, photographs, can make a big difference to that grieving process, because it is such a huge loss, and I can't imagine what that loss must have been like for a young man with a young dad.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so to have like that legacy project, as it's sometimes called, as something to hold on to that has such great meaning, can provide an element or a degree of comfort in the midst of that loss. So I think we'll wrap it up there today. A huge thank you to Spencer for sharing that with us all today.
Dementia in Practice is an initiative of Dementia Training Australia, which is funded by the Australian Government.
If you are a GP and you'd like to claim CPD points for listening to this episode, check out our suggestions in the show notes section.